to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
I've been at Microsoft about 13 years. The last about 2.5 or 3 years has been in the Microsoft Research organization. If Microsoft overall is a corporation of about 100,000 people, the research division of PhDs in computer science is about 900 people. Of that, about half of those are located in Redmond. Half of them are located around the world in research sites and innovation centers. Whereas I mentioned, most of those have PhDs in computer science and are working on longer-term projects, you know, 5, 7, 10-year projects, our team is much more applied, much more focused. We are kind of looking more of time frames of 12 months, 18 months, 24 months in terms of getting the projects out there. How we do that, and hence the name external research, is we don't do the research ourselves. We actually fund and partner with researchers outside of our company. So we will work with the academy, we will work with government agencies, nonprofit, or in some cases maybe commercial publishers, et cetera, to develop technologies, to develop functionality that we think would benefit the community overall, and if there's some role that Microsoft can play in facilitating that that process, that's what we do. That's enough of the commercial talk. The rest of it is going to be the observations that I've made over the 3 years of working in this space. I'd also like to introduce Alex Wade, my colleague from Microsoft Research. If the questions get really tough, I'm going to give them to him. The themes that I would like to touch on over the course of my talk will be obviously the tsunami of data that is starting to overwhelm scholarship, and the daunting issues that raises for the scholarly communication lifecycle. The concept of moving upstream, how librarians, how publishers, how authors and individual researchers can really begin to move upstream and take more control over the process, and thereby making it better further downstream. I will look at that about how we can integrate or how the functionality that we need to surface out of the tools and out of the lifecycle can be integrated into existing tools and existing workflows. One of the huge themes that our group likes to pursue in our work in the scholarly communication space is enabling semantic computing. So I'm going to talk about what that means and some examples that we've noticed in the ecosystem. One of the largest themes that I will be touching on is the provision of services. I think this is the future of scholarly communication. So we'll be talking about tools related to data analysis, to collaboration, and finally some interesting developments related to preservation and the capture and delivery provenance. I'm going to be talking about the potential for cloud services. And then lastly, I'm going to make some comments that might get me fired back when I go home to Redmond, but hopefully not. I think the issue here, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on, I think we're all aware of it, data-driven science, data-driven research is an unbelievable, we have no idea. I think we can talk about the numbers, but we literally haven't begun to either calculate or really we can envision it, but we haven't really done enough with it, and it's an unbelievable scale problem that we can theorize around, but I don't think we've really tackled it at the scale that we're going to need to. That said, computing is stepping up to both create the problem and help us solve the problem. We're seeing massive data sets, which is raising the issue around the federation of those data sets, integration of those data sets, and collaboration of scholars and across those. The evolution of mini-core and multi-core computing is, again, like I said, contributing to the problem, but is also going to be the way that we address the problem. And then there's the potential of the power of the client and the cloud, and how we'll be able to access this data, access this information anywhere and anytime. these are kind of the underpinning of a lot of the solutions that I think we'll be envisioning and that I'll be speaking about today. But to capture, to characterize the situation as it is now, there is the ongoing need to collect this data. Scientists have been collecting this data and have been, in some ways delivering it as part of the scholarly communication lifecycle. But I don't think that the rest of the workflow over, in the last 300 or 400 years or even in the last 20 or 30 years, we've been able to really take good advantage of that. What we are starting to see is this data processing, analysis, and visualization. We're still in the very, very early days of this. And then archiving, this is, traditionally role of archives, of librarians, and it's been in a very paper-based form, and the mind reels at how we're going to address this issue going forward. But this is a real, as we would say, opportunity. These are issues, these are challenges, but these are also the ways that we need to solve and address the problem. Again, to characterize the issue, I'm going to touch upon a project. This is just some statistics from the Life Under Your Feet. I'll move over to the side here. Sorry, the Life Under Your Feet project at Johns Hopkins, and this just gives you. I mean, this is again a drop in the bucket. This is just one example of a research project. This is being, there are, arguably, tens of thousands of these around the world, but it just gives you an idea. 200 wireless, computers, 10 sensors each. We're looking at, something over 200 million measurements per year. This is a three-year project, et cetera. How do they capture this? How do they maintain it? How do they curate this? How do they turn around and compare it with other like data sets around the world? How do they share that information, et cetera? This is a fantastic project. This is one of many, actually, that Microsoft is funding out of Microsoft Research to work exactly around data sharing, data collaboration, and data curation. But just to give you an idea of the kind of magnitude of what we're looking at. This raises the issue, Joe Hellerstein is a fantastic blogger, and I would highly recommend that you check out his blog, but this is a specific one where he referred to as the commoditization of massive data analysis. And you'll see, he's pointing out, and I've kind of highlighted some of the concepts, but I like the idea that he's touching on that we haven't even arrived at the industrial revolution of data yet. We're in such early days, and as much as we think we're so advanced and we have all these tools and our resources, we're at the very, very, very early stages. And then as you can see on the slides, I ask a couple of rhetorical questions here. I'm not going to answer them. I wish I could, but I can guarantee that the answer to that is going to be yes. The cloud issue, that answer is going to be yes. And then to characterize that problem, but then to put it in the aspect of what it looks like to your typical e-scientist or e-researcher, you've got obviously data coming from experiments and instruments. You've got data coming from other existing archives, pre-existing, searching the literature, pulling out data from simulations that might be based on the first two. And then you've got all the problems. And the amazing thing is right now, the individual research scientist or the individual lab is having to do and take on all of that. And on the other end, you might have the library or the archive or the someone at some point in the university or the organization who's in charge of the repository trying to receive this at some other point. This is an incredibly complex workflow and one that has grown expansively in the last 20 years. And we've all kind of tackled bits and parts of it, but we've run into a handful of best practices, which we're going to be chatting about here. But there is an immense amount of opportunity, I will stress that word again, that's happening in this space. Now, I mentioned the concept of moving upstream. And this is, I think, a very, I'm going to use the word opportunity about 400 times, I think. But this is represents for us, and I mean scholars, I mean researchers, I mean corporations, I mean open access publishers, I mean librarians and archivists. There is an immense amount of work that needs to be done, but an immense amount, it's an exciting time because there is kind of no baseline. There is only opportunity to do that. And so I'm going to give you some examples of what I mean, by moving upstream. if there's an organizing metaphor that I would like to refer to, it's the research life cycle, or what I'll refer to as the scholarly communication life cycle. The idea of collecting your data, doing your research, doing your analysis, moving to a phase of authoring where actually you've got your thesis and I'm going to write it down. Then there's the idea of sharing it, the need to publish and disseminate that. You might be blogging about your research results. You might be writing an article or writing a book or giving a paper at a professional conference. But in somehow making those first two steps public in a way to share it with your colleagues in the domain. And then ideally, moving to a phase where you store that and you make it, you archive it and you preserve it for future generations and for others. So if we think about these as four core sets of this life cycle, I'm going to add to that two other concepts. The need to collaborate, and that is collaborating within and across those four core steps. And then additionally, the need for discovery, the need to search and find information within and across those sets. And so I just list this as a kind of an organizing metaphor. I think traditionally, from a library and archives or curation point of view, this is typically where, I won't say where the process starts, but where libraries and archives spend most of their time. And I think where we need to really think about data curation is moving back up that life cycle. And that's why I mentioned the moving upstream concept. I think we need to be addressing a lot of these problems much earlier on. My observation is from working with kind of leading edge innovators in e-science or e-research, there are the most forward thinkers in this space are people that realize that and are working very hard at data capture and data curation at the very early stages and worrying about how to capture that information, how to share it, the protocols, very, very carefully scripting that. And those are the people that we're trying to work with in terms of best practices. And then being able to make sure that it moves throughout that entire life cycle, that it's not just operating in silos. The trick there is integration. And how do we, as we move from step to step, to be able to take not only the data, the metadata, and the provenance, and ship that around? And this is another point that I'll make later in the talk. It's very problematic. Sometimes there are domains that are very, very cohesive and very non-proprietary about their research. There are others that are very proprietary. And being able to get data curation standards and protocols in those specific domains can be very problematic. But it's very, I'd say, inherent on the data curators in wherever stage they may be. Maybe it's publishers, maybe it's librarians, maybe it's people in the labs. To be able to integrate and be able to move things from system to system based on those protocols and based on interoperability. So the interest from my company's perspective is how can we facilitate the move from what we would think of as, you know, 400 or 500 years of the scholarly article? How can we move from these very static summaries to much richer information vehicles? And so, you know, as you can see here, pace of science is picking up, status quo is being challenged, there are some innovators, there are some people that are dragging, but we maintain, and I'll provide some examples of others in the ecosystem, that there is an immense amount that is available. That's why I'm kind of pointing out the bottom below the surface. There's just an immense amount. If we can imagine that the container that is the scientific article, that it has the ability to serve as and facilitate reproducible science. The ability to, when you get a paper, you also get the data, you also get machine-readable, we'll say, you know, methodology. You're able to reproduce that methodology against your data set or share your data set with someone else and let them utilize the methodology. Interactive data, the ability for you to pull out a table, change a figure, easily insert it back in and ship that document off. Or for you to be doing this on the web and not be thinking about a specific document, whether that be a PDF, a Word document, or something online in that way. The ability to collaborate real time with other researchers. Dynamic documents that literally changing on the fly. Or the ability for reputation and influence to be captured, to be passed on and shared. In the way, these are all the themes that we're starting to see. We're starting to see resident in examples, online, certain commercial journals, open access journals are all starting to dabble with this. A couple of points specific to that I'd like to call out. We're seeing interesting work, for instance, from on the commercial side. Elsevier has been doing this Article of the Future competition. They also have a grand challenge that they issue every year. These are producing some fascinating ideas. I'll be making this slide deck available, and these are live links. And if you're not familiar with these are annual. I think these are about 2 years old. And every year, these get a fair amount of attention. But obviously, very scientific focus because it's Elsevier. But amazing ways that they're working within different domains to show how collaboration and how dissemination of information can work. Recently, I think this is probably about a month ago, as you might have heard, Public Library of Science, PLOS, started a new, channel for delivering information that they're referring to as Currents. And their specific focus was the H1N1 flu. And what they're doing, as you can see here, is it's fundamentally, how do they phrase it? It does not go in-depth peer review. It's actually, the whole point here is not to drag things out through a 6, 12, 18-month peer review process, but to have a handful of experts in the field review it very quickly and get it out as quickly as possible. And this is a partnership between NIH, PLOS, and being published on Google Knoll. And I think this is a fascinating thing. I think a lot of journals would blanch the concept that this is important scientific information that isn't receiving full peer review. And I think this is, and that is not different from the Nature Proceedings work. This is basically a preprint service that Nature, a publishing group, has been offering for 2.5 or 3 years. And I think these are interesting in that, and I probably represent the future, in that you're starting to see a chink in the armor of the peer review system, that people are starting to say it's more important to get information out, even maybe it's not the 99 or 100% solution, but if it is advancing the cause and advancing science, let's get it out there as quickly as possible. Another interesting thing that's been announced over the last 6 or 9 months that has garnered, I think, a great deal of interest is the Google Wave. And I myself haven't spent enough time on it, but watching the blogs and watching the people that we work with, there's a lot of interest into what this means. You know, time will tell as to how, if we see adoption of Google Wave, but the opportunities for scholarly communication have been heightened, and some of the leaders and innovators in the field have jumped on this, and what that could mean for changes, especially when you talk about the commercial publishing world. And then lastly, just another part of the chain is Mendeley, I think PC-based, and the Papers, which is a Mac-based application. Many different people have referred to at least Mendeley, but Papers as well, as kind of the iTunes for academic papers, a way for you to download and store basically your own repository on your desktop of the papers that you're looking. And then it recommends, if you're interested in these papers, not unlike an Amazon recommender service, the ability. And this is amazing, as you'll see. 60,000 people have already signed up. 4 million scientific papers have been uploaded, and that's doubling about every 10 weeks. So this is a small company that we actually chatted with a couple of times, probably 6 months ago, and they've seen some amazing growth. So it's some differing ways that you're seeing peer review being scaled back a little bit, papers being distributed in different ways, not unlike maybe archive.org, et cetera, but new paradigms for how this how information is being transferred within and across academic domains. So that raises the point of, how are we going to see the world as we've known it for several hundred years around scholarly publishing? How are we going to see that change? And this is going to be in the world of open access, taking a larger role, and the idea of paid and walled content starting to break down and go away. How are we going to see different entities continue to, derive value out of that content? And it's not going to be necessarily the content itself, but it's going to be adding services on top of that. And there's many ways that we're going to see how that happens. The benefit is we're now finally in a world where research is easily shareable. We're not talking about 100 pages of tables of statistics in the back of a journal from 1800. We're now able to send a spreadsheet or download something from a web service. So the data now is easily shareable, and interoperability is still a bit of an issue, but I think we're going to be tackling that. From a an interesting scenario related to data sharing. Many of you might be familiar with this Sloan Digital Sky Survey. This is some fantastic work by astronomers at many institutions and organizations around the world. But you can see that they've got 3 terabytes of fully public information from 13 institutions, 300 million objects, et cetera. An amazing job that these institutions have done to pull data from different sources, different formats, and pull it together and make it available in a consumable form. And on top of that, the amazing thing is you can see 350 million web hits in 6 years, and we have let's round up, 1 million distinct users versus a known population of astronomers worldwide of 10,000. So we're starting to see when you put this data out there and you put it in a consumable form, you're seeing much broader interest outside of the domain. It's fascinating to me. The greatest example, and I point to Galaxy Zoo, is basically the Mechanical Turk concept of making this data available and having people kind of drill down into it and help them, have them classify different aspects of it. This has received the Galaxy Zoo since it launched, I think about 18 or 20, 24 months ago. It's received a lot of publicity. There's been a lot of public access to this information. Over 100,000 people participating. The one that you may have heard of is, a Dutch homemaker who was, for some reason, looking at this, found a unique object, flagged it. It immediately got escalated to some of the most senior people involved in this. And it was referred to as a blue object that they had not ever seen before. Based on that response, they've actually, several months ago, turned the Hubble telescope to look at that specific thing. And sure enough, this woman identified an object that had never been heretofore discovered. So it's an amazing concept of sharing that data and the possibilities for citizen science to help facilitate that, do something that those 10,000 astronomers may not have been able to do for many, many years. Obviously, there are concerns with data sharing. I think the astronomy community is at the forefront in terms of making this information available, making it available beyond their domain. But it's an immense task for integrating it, ensuring the interoperability among those data sets. There's a challenge around annotating it, making sure that people can say, oh, wait, we need to look into this, or this is an anomaly, or this is great, or who did this? Basically, again, kind of starting to touch on the next point there, provenance and the quality of the data. And it's annotating it at a high level and annotating it perhaps even at the individual atomic data point level. Exporting it and publishing it in agreed formats, again, kind of mapping back to the interoperability issue. And then security. How do you share this? When do you share it? With whom do you share it? These are all issues that I think in many domains have stopped people from doing data sharing, have stopped people, have forced communities to become proprietary. And I stress to you, I would look at the same list and say, these are exactly the opportunity areas that will provide, whether it be libraries, institutions, whether it be commercial publishers, the people that are able to address these problems in clever ways are going to be the market differentiators moving forward. And so these are exactly the areas that I would love to see institutions, I would love to see scholarly societies, I'd love to see libraries address these issues in an open and interoperable way. Other services, data analysis. I'm listing a handful of names here. Swivel, which is independent, IBM's MiniEyes, Google's GapMinder, Metabase's Freebase. There are many others. Some of these are kind of more on a different scale. But the idea in all of these is that these are open web-based services that are being made available. Some have kind of baseline services that are available for free, and if you want premium services, you have to subscribe at a different level. But the idea that you can take in multiple data sets, and I mean, one example is I would encourage you to go up to Swivel and look at the public data sets that people have loaded up. Again, provenance and security are issues, but for the ones that are up there, it's amazing the data mashups that you can create, or the free tools if you wanted to load your own data up and run it against yourself or your colleagues, these free services that are now being made available. To me, again, these are fantastic tools that the academic community could be using as models. Maybe you're not want to use this, but maybe you want to build services that are in a very similar vein. But I think these are tools that should certainly be utilized. I personally have only used MiniEyes for textual analysis, and it's a fantastic tool. I'd recommend checking it out if you haven't already. But based on these tools, based on these things, we're really starting to see the publishing ecosystem shift. And we are seeing some of the commercial publishers investigating, and again, things like the Elsevier Grand Challenge, starting to say, hey, can you guys give us some ideas? And then, you know, maybe we'll incubate that. Maybe we'll, pursue some of these ideas. But we're definitely seeing publishers think about these sorts of services. I'm really interested, if you take a look at another world, and you look at the world that I'm very familiar with of software, you know, you've seen open source, and you've seen IBM and Red Hat really build, they're not selling the code, but they're selling the services on top of the code. And this is, a model that I think a lot of publishers are probably going to be looking at and adopting, the idea that, hey, the content can be free, but the services, that's where the value add, or that's where the differentiator, or that's where the financial remuneration might happen. The other thing is, this provides very rapid prototyping, and so it, especially if you're starting to not get concentrated or not focused on the peer review as we've traditionally known it, but the idea to build analytical services and visualization services, et cetera, allows very rapid prototyping and very unique things to happen. And we can envision, and it's already starting to happen, days when repositories won't be simply the full text of research papers, but they'll be able to include and incorporate the great literature supporting around those papers, data, images, maybe software emulations, etc., that will support that. So that we need to evolve away from, again, just the traditional concept of the paper, and think about all of the things, the content in the paper and what it could represent. So I'm stating the obvious on the last point, but to make all of this happen, some enhanced concepts of interoperability protocols are very, very necessary. A couple of examples that I think is to illustrate the point. Very familiar with data.gov, but there it's fantastic to see that shortly after the new administration change, but there was this push within the government to say, we've been collecting and we've been making this data available to ourselves for a long period of time. Hey, there's a onus on us to turn around and make it available make it available to all the taxpayers. And so it's been fantastic to watch data.gov really take off, and not unlike the concept of Swivel, but we're starting to see some really baseline services delivered this way as well. Another idea that I like quite a bit is, I'm not sure if folks are familiar with, but worldwidescience.org. And this is an amalgamation of government agencies or other bodies in different worldwide countries that are responsible for maintaining scientific and technical information on the behalf of their country. So the types of groups that would be participating from the United States would be Department of Energy or NSF, et cetera. But a lot, see if they have the number here, it's probably somewhere around 60 or 70 different countries that are participating. But they are pulling together all of their scientific information and, again, in a kind of UN of scientific data, they're pulling all of this information together and providing a search, a federated search across that. And I think this is fantastic because they're not going to publishers. It could be the British Library. It could be individual agencies. It could be scientific and technical information agencies in Korea and Russia, et cetera, that are getting together and doing this regardless of borders, regardless of language, pulling together. I think this is a fantastic model, and it's something where certain institutions are saying we'll worry about the data curation, other ones are saying we're going to worry about the crawling and the indexing, and they're dividing and conquering and tackling it again kind of in a UN fashion. It's fantastic to see. A lot has happened in this space over the last 2 to 3 years. So this is something I think is a fantastic model to emulate. Now, the concept of enabling semantic computing is an interesting one. The tough thing is people have been talking about semantics and semantic computing for years, and we still are talking about it. We're still not kind of feeling the benefit of it. I'm one of the people that has kind of jumped the chasm and definitely feel like there's going to be extreme benefit for us in the long run. And so a lot of the efforts that happen within our group, our research group at Microsoft, are focused on enabling this. But it still might be a while before the kind of rank and file are able to enjoy the benefits of what we're going to see in this space. Pointing to another blogger, Cameron Nalon from the UK, he has a blog called Science in the Open, and I love the highlights here, where he says the laboratory record is reduced to a feed which describes the relationships between samples, procedures, and data, stressing the point that yeah, the data is great, but the next step is understanding the relationships between the data. And the relationships between the data and the paper and the methodology and the co-authors that are written and the expansion of linked data out from the individual atomic data points. And then he points out what is also requires is good plugins, applications, and services to help people generate the lab record feed. It also requires a minimal and arbitrary extensible way of describing the relationships. Again, here's the opportunity. Again, stepping away from simply the paper and starting to think about the data and how we can enable that. And by the whole promise, and I think I'll probably skip ahead to the next slide, the whole promise that this represents is the ability of tagging and identifying these relationships and letting machines generate this intelligence, this artificial intelligence that is things that we, our minds will not be able to capture, but only via high performance computing will we be able to see this. And I want to stress that there's a distinction between semantic technologies and the semantic web. Semantic web is one of the many tools at our disposal, but there are semantic based solutions that have to be operationalized at much lower levels. That's just kind of one manifestation or one channel that we will see. So how do we start to arrive? How do we take advantage of these things? So yes, there's the idea of leveraging collective intelligence. There is, at a very simple way, there's the concepts of these recommender systems, Last.fm, or when you're buying something on Amazon, yes, other people who bought this also bought. That's brain dead in a lot of ways in comparison to the benefit or the promise of semantic computing. And so we're starting, there are applications of these recommender systems, Connetia, Biomed Central's Faculty of 1000, but by comparison, these are very manual. They're not literally manual, but they're very still kind of peer review based or some kind of basic social networking. But there is the idea of this automated correlation of scientific data and smart composition of services and functionality. The idea that things that we would have never been able to compute or think about on our own, if we're able to describe those relationships between things and let the computers do that, do the connections, we're going to be in a much better space when these things are realized. The other point that I'd like to stress here is that we're not all going to have supercomputers under our desk to do these things. And in the near term, I envision and I think very strongly that we're going to be as a academic community leveraging cloud computing more and more. We see a lot of usage going around the world. We see a lot of usage. Yes, it's great, and scientists all would like to have massive computing powers. A lot of them are starting to use things like Amazon EC2 or Amazon S3 to store their information or to do their calculations. And I think that is a model that it's going to ramp up quite a bit. So, kind of reiterating the last point, in a world where all data is linked, and this is the linkdata.org, kind of an ever-evolving diagram of linked data. It's very much worth a visit to that site. There's an immense amount of potential, but when we have the ability to demonstrate and catalog these networks, you can imagine when everything is stored, processed, and analyzed in the cloud, the kind of services that can just be automatically generated: knowledge management, knowledge discovery, virtualization, storage services, notification of you can easily start to capitalize on, especially if you're not focused on the storage and the compute. If you're able to kind of basically offshore or outsource that, and you're able to focus on delivering these services, I think it's, again, a much greater value add for our respective roles, whether it be as authors, as scientists, as librarians, as archivists, some form or fashion. When we talk about cloud computing, just for a point of distinction, many people have kind of broken into three categories. This is actually from Tim O'Reilly, but the idea of kind of very baseline infrastructure, utility computing, moving up a level to platform and platform as a service, and there's examples of Salesforce.com, Google's App Engine, many things in that area. And then finally, the thing that I think we're most all familiar with, the idea of software, end-user applications, things like Facebook, things like Search, Amazon, et cetera. But these would be the three levels. And what I was mentioning earlier is I think this is, for most of us in the scholarly communication or research world, we would love to be able to not worry about those and spend our time in this area. So this is the opportunity space. And I think this isn't a very, very obvious concept, but why would we want to do this? So we don't all have to have a supercomputer sitting under our desk, but there are many reasons that would that are going to lead us to cloud computing. And it just, again, takes a huge chunk of time, resources, and effort off of the table and allows us to think of much higher value-add services. Certainly the cloud landscape is still developing, but to get an idea of the services that are already out there, we may not even think about them as cloud services, but the idea of Flickr, of SmugMug, et cetera, for photos, for video, obviously we know about YouTube. How many people are familiar with Sci-V? Handful, four or five. Sci-V is basically YouTube for scientists. And the idea of, and it's free, it was actually NSF funded, came out of UC San Diego, but it's the idea of, you know what, I've got a 75-page physics paper and I really don't want to read it, I'm exaggerating, but instead of reading the abstract or the entire paper, why don't I go and watch the author who actually did it do a 10 or 5 or 7-minute video that explains the concepts and maybe actually demonstrates. So there's another similar thing called JOVE, the Journal of Visualized Experiments. And it's an amazing use that is really kind of a layer above the article. You could also save a lot of money traveling to conferences if you want to just take a look at these things online. I'll jump back to SmugMug for a second. How many people are familiar with SmugMug? So only three or four. The amazing thing about SmugMug is it's Flickr, but they own no infrastructure. They are completely utilizing Amazon SC3 and EC2. They have zero IT infrastructure. And so they've built their entire business on top of Amazon, which is a risk, but I think in a lot of ways that they're a very forward-thinking company and that they're saying, we're just going to take that part of the equation off the table and we're going to worry about doing more value-added services. Obviously, other ones include SlideShare for presentations, Google Docs for word processing, spreadsheets. We're seeing a lot of these end-user tools that are already available in the cloud. But in a certain way, these only go to a certain degree, and it's not the last mile for what scholars and for what researchers need. And I think that there's a gulf there that is, again, an opportunity for people to step in and begin to take advantage of these resources and build those compelling and value-added services in the middle. I mentioned Amazon's S3 and EC2. I'm going to skip over the DuraCloud project because I have a slide on that in a moment. But the idea that we could start leveraging these resources to do the hard aspects of archiving and preservation that have heretofore been very difficult and we've kind of prevented us from doing it, these things are starting to get to be a lot easier. And then there's the idea of new business models that are developing in this space. Service provision could be a new way to sustainability for some journals or for some societies. I'm also interested to see the NSF DataNet solicitation. They're actually in round two, doing a second round of solicitation. These are $20 million four-year grants that are being given not to one institution, but coalitions of institutions that are coming together. In the first round, it was Johns Hopkins and probably about 8 or 10 partners got awarded the first one, as well as... was it, I'm trying to remember if it was Oak Ridge and University of New Mexico, but those are the two first awardees. But the idea behind these is saying, okay, all of the problems I've been talking about around collecting data, storing data, and preserving it to make sure that the scientific data is available, NSF said, we realize this is a problem, and we're going to get groups of not just individual institutions, but groups of institutions together with a specific mandate, A, to create sustainable digital preservation solutions, and something that they have to turn around and make available. So they have to actually produce something, not just a prototype, but something that can be turned around and shared with the community. And there, I know NSF is in the second round of awards for that at present. But it's to me, it's a very interesting evolution in thinking that these aren't based around actually developing new data. It's taking existing data and data moving forward, and how do we preserve that and ensure that it's going to be around. And the mandate is on these is to say, not just it's a four-year grant and your funding runs out, but there's a goal, a stated goal of the thing, that these have to be sustainable, and you have to build a business model for how these will continue after the initial four-year grant. Then preservation and provenance. I mentioned the DuraCloud project. This is, for those of you that are familiar with DSpace, Fedora, they actually merged, there were two separate open source software repository packages. They actually merged into a single entity about 6 months ago, which is they're now referred to as DuraSpace. And they are initiating a project that is called DuraCloud. And this is the idea that at the top level here, you might have hundreds, thousands, in fact, you know, we are probably talking somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 institutional or centralized repositories around the world, several here on the Harvard campus, several over at MIT, et cetera, but, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 of these worldwide. And right now, they don't have a very good, you know, backup or plan B or plan C in terms of how they're preserving that data. Some are experimenting, but in terms of how could they scale this, or how could they really address this in a much larger order or fashion. And so what the DuraSpace team has done is they went to the Mellon Foundation and said, we would like to build a business, a scalable, large-scale business around preserving information at these academic institutions for these institutional repositories. And so what DuraCloud will be doing is providing this area, providing this durable durable storage service layer, and then so they would basically, you know, let's take the Dash repository here at Harvard. Dash could go to DuraCloud and say, I would like to sign a service level agreement with you. I will have a local store of my data, but then I will store a backup or store a mirror with you. And then what DuraCloud does is turn around and they go to HP, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, whoever, and they sign, and they are able to distribute and share multiple copies at different locations, et cetera. So there's two agreements that are going on, but this is the best application I can think of in terms of cloud computing and preservation. And it's a large scale. This is something that, I know the DuraCloud people are talking with everyone. We hope to be one of the providers behind the scenes as well, but I just think this is a brilliant approach. And obviously, institutions will be paying for this service, will be funded in that way, and these services will be attract this kind of ecosystem as well. Another blogger, John Wilbanks, from his Science Commons blog, I think raises an interesting point that I will be closing on. We need more than computer software, routers, and fiber to share scientific information more efficiently. We need a legal and policy infrastructure that supports better yet rewards sharing. And so the point that I close on here, and I stress that you read more of his blog, but this is what I hope doesn't get me fired back at Redmond. But at the end of the day, it's not exclusively software. Yes, I've been talking about the opportunity, et cetera, but it's, as we all know, I wish I could say, I've got the answer, and here it is, X, Y, Z. But at the end of the day, it's making sure that people are participating in this, that we can encourage, that we can provide incentives and rewards, that we can perhaps revisit what peer review looks like or what the tenure process looks like. These are things that have to change, that have to evolve. And it's going to be different in every domain. It's going to be different from institution to institution. But at the end of the day, you know, as much as I'm as a software vendor, as much as I can say, I'd love for there to be some code that we could write that would address the situation. But at the end, it's a sociological issue that has to be addressed as well. It's a key part of that equation. So I will point you, this is the last little tiny bit of a commercial, but this is just a website that describes some of the work that we're doing at Microsoft Research, just research.microsoft.com. And then lastly, I will just share my information, my email contact, and a website about the specific area that we work with. So I would like to open it up to questions. There might be questions coming in from the Twitter feed, but thank you very much. Oh yeah. Well, and again, some of it's happening already. I had a couple of the examples. You know, the Elsevier Plus, very interesting things. And it's just a matter of these are. You know, I look at Plus as a very forward-thinking organization, Public Library of Science, and it just has to be an issue of are the domains. You know, they're a leading edge, and an innovator, but the domains have to kind of latch on and start taking it and running with it. Another example is Google Wave. Fascinating potential, but it's been tossed out there, and it remains to be seen if communities are going to adopt it. In a lot of ways, you look at domains like astronomy or physics or chemistry, very guild-like, kind of old school, and you have some innovators and some laggards, and it's just going to be interesting when we can see like a tipping point happen in certain areas. And I feel like the onus is on the people in this room, the people in these institutions, to say how do we lead them, across that chasm. What are the compelling, rewards or incentives or services that we can provide to say, don't do it the old way, do it the new way. So I wish I knew. I wish I could say when, but I think it's going to vary from domain to domain, from institution to institution. Yes. Yeah. So I think to quickly characterize the questions. If we look at the consumer space, what could we start seeing kind of bleeding over into the academic or public sector in that way? I think it's an amazing space to watch. I think I tried to list a couple. I think examples like Sivy, like SlideShare, et cetera. There are certain things that Sivy where you can say, okay, well, yes, there's YouTube, but how do we build a special application of that for scientists? We see a little of that. I think the consumer space is a fantastic. It's interesting. You used to think of the consumers. The business space maybe influencing the consumer space, and we've seen a complete reverse of that. And we're seeing a lot of things bubble up from there and applied to the academic world there or to the private sector world there. I'm trying to think of other examples that I've seen, and again, it all depends on. And from my perspective, it all depends on when that gets adopted by the leading people in the field, the innovators in the field, and if they can kind of jump that chasm and make it more broadly useful, or broadly applicable. So it varies. there are certainly examples of it, Smug Mug, et cetera. There are things like that, but yes.
This is great. I'm really, really happy to have you proselytize it. That's wonderful. So I do want to ask a question to the fire. Okay. So when proselytizing internally at Microsoft,
yes.
What do you see as the issues that need to be overcome there, if any?
Yes.
And how's it going?
Yeah. Whereas 50% of my job is talking externally, or I should characterize that as by talking some and trying to listen more, to your point, the rest of our job is going back inside the company and acting as a conduit, acting as an advocate for the higher education space overall. And whether that be from a teaching and learning and education space or a research and scholarly communication space, myself, Alex, others in the external research group are literally your advocates to turn around and trying to make the case, make the business case within the company. And so that's our job inside the company. And so what we've done over the course of the existence of our specific group over the last 3 years is Exactly. Come out to venues like this, sit in meetings, attend academic conferences, listen, hear what the pain points are, find out what the innovators are doing, whether it's on our software, whether it's on open source software, whether it's on competitive software, but turn around and go back into the product group and say, guys, look to kind of to your point, look what these leading people are doing, or look what is happening in the consumer space, and look at what we can do inside Word with SQL, with SharePoint, etc. Oh, okay. So that's a whole different presentation. I mean, we had another meeting on campus where we did a little bit of that this morning. So yes, we are building. We probably built 6 or 8 add-ins for Microsoft Office that facilitate chemical drawing, semantic markup, writing academic articles, the consumption of ontologies in journals, in Word documents. We've built a tool for facilitating collaboration on top of SharePoint that facilitates collaboration among scientists and academics. We built a repository software platform that allows people to build repositories. I would recommend that you maybe check out the website. It's microsoft.com/scholarlycom, and that will take you to the list of the products the projects that we've produced.
And that's our group, much larger. And one of the things I think is going to make an even bigger impact is that we just recently announced an open source foundation, separate from Microsoft, called the CodeFlex Foundation. And that really unlocks a lot of things that was blocking Microsoft in the past. We're actually able to contribute to open source projects now. We just contributed 25,000 lines of code to the Linux kernel for driver support. So there were things that even where philosophically people were turning around at Microsoft, there were things that we could not do. And now we're able to do that. So it's changing.
A lot more to be said, but you probably get the idea. Yes?
Yes, it's more common than a question here. But here at Harvard, the Institute for Quantitative Social Science, we have developed an end user application actually that addresses all the concerns that you listed in the data sharing. Mm-hmm. And in addition, it adds the data analysis for tabular data, mostly social science for tabular data, but for network data, for social network data. I'd just be very interested in showing. Because it has a lot of the. It goes through all the issues that you have posted here, and we try to address one by one. And besides, one thing that it has been discussed as about how people actually adopt it afterwards, right? It's the issue is not only the software providing this as a service. That's software is open source, it's free to have data. But the main thing that has helped to adopt it across researchers across the world has been to give ownership of the, at least provide the perception of ownership of the data. So they create their own site, they upload it there, we take care of all the archiving, provide all the services to their site, but they can configure completely their site, basically the Facebook of research data.
That sounds like a fantastic best practice. So I definitely want to talk to you, and I'd like to have a slide about the work that you guys are doing. That's fantastic. Please, let's follow up.
Is it called Dataverse?
Yes, it's Dataverse. Yeah. And the developers are here.
Okay, fantastic. Fantastic. Other questions? Yes?
When you were going through, many of your examples were data sets and science.
Yes.
With data sets.
Yes.
And data is sort of agnostic, but once data is used and papers are written, I was wondering Elsevier is doing something, but how published texts were they going to keep up with data sets? Were things going to be developed for them? But now it sounds like you are developing things for written texts.
Mm-hmm.
And actually authoring the text.
Yes. So, I mean, there's many ways of thinking about it. So a lot of the work that our group is doing is how can we take documents that are written in a Word file traditionally, how can we evolve that? How can we, capture that in XML? How can we embed data sets and images, et cetera, in that and send that document around? How can we semantically mark up? How can we include information? That's one idea. right? And that, so these are some of the experiments we're doing. Other, some of the things I've talked about is how can you say, we're not going to worry about PDFs, we're not going to worry about Word docs, how can we do it on the web? Things like Google Wave, things about, you know, just the representation of on HTML. There's places that are saying we don't need to think about these old containers anymore, we can do it in a virtual way on the web. And so there's those, and those are some of the other areas of exploration. We want to be able to look and observe at all of those.
One of the ideas that seems key to me is when you were talking about IDing relationships. Mm-hmm. And are you providing a way to do that? I mean, or
yes.
Are you addressing
that? Yes, like in part. Yes, and again, we're taking the tools that people are most familiar with, which is one approach of saying for, you know, in certain areas, Word is or PowerPoint or Excel, very common tool for authoring or capturing information. In those areas, we're trying to build ways to allow scholars or allow researchers to define those relationships, to import ontologies, mark up the document, define those relationships, and share that maybe with a repository or with a database or with a publisher when they submit that. So yes, we are doing that. There's other examples of the work that we're doing where the research output repository platform that we built is taking advantage of that and doing the calculations and the linking and the semantic calculations to pull those and document those relationships. So there's examples that we're doing, and as well as other organizations.
And partnering with other organizations.
Yep. Yeah, I'll stress that. We're, as much as I'd say, woo, it'd be great if you did everything on Microsoft, we know that that's not going to happen. And so our main focus is to say, when and if you use Microsoft software, we want to make sure that it's not a hindrance, but it facilitates your interaction. If you put data into it, you get the same data out or better data out of that in that process. So that's the kind of effort that we're doing in Microsoft Research.
Yes? I have a quick question. What's the latest developments in terms of how data is being tagged or marked up semantically, sort of automatically on the fly as it's generated? Because a lot of the times it seems like there's this curation step. Scientists take like an Excel spreadsheet from their whatever it is and then put it into a computer, and then eventually it ends up sort of tagged. But it seems like really before this will take off, the machine doing the measurement really has to know how to tag it. Mm-hmm. What's going on with that?
Exactly. An excellent idea. So exactly. I would actually, one idea, so I would not feel, there are basically machines that are doing blogging, right? And that are able to, you know, put thing out. You're able to do the tagging of that information that's coming off, feeding into a certain place, and it's being tagged automatically. But I'm not experiencing that. I don't have enough background there. What we are doing within Microsoft, I can talk a little bit about. Actually, I can point to Alex. And I would mention the Kimfer word. I mean, how are we doing the semantic markup and the data in the? We have built an add-in that facilitates chemical authoring and semantic markup for chemistry.
Yeah, and that's definitely part of it. I mean, it's within the authoring environment. The two examples that I think are most interesting right now. There's multiple examples of this, but the chemistry group at Southampton University has all of their instruments measuring. Environmental variables, measuring machine outputs, every single thing that somebody was having to record in a lab notebook is all being recorded for them, being output directly to the blog. So when you go and record your experiment, you say, I was in this room at this time, and you're effectively creating a data mashup between your lab notebook and what the room is telling you what went on.
Is that where Cameron Nayland is?
Yes,
is
that yes. Exactly right.
When you move into the sort of automatic step, there's a group at the Oxford Research Center that's doing some work in the cancer research space that is allowing researchers to semantically annotate within the Excel environment. So instead of just having a column and a row, and you don't know if it's, you may be able to tell it's temperature, but you don't know if it's Fahrenheit or Celsius, or you know that it's an instrument that was recording this particular stream of data, the underlying XML of that Excel spreadsheet now is annotated pointing to an ontology that says this experiment was used, this is how the data was gathered, this is the units that it's in, so that then when you upload it, there's no further processing. You have another format that goes into another system. That's all carried along.
The units problem really seems like a tricky part. It's unavoidable. That's just my comment. Thanks.
Another example to look at it in terms of, I would say, best practice in data curation is the fluxnet.org. And that is, it's something like 100 different organizations worldwide that are all calculating or capturing water and hydration data from around the world, and working in a cooperative single framework to capture that information and share it. And it's a great story about non-proprietary sharing of information, curation across data sets, etc. Yes.
It seems like we're increasingly blurring the lines between what I traditionally consider scholarly information and a wide range of other kinds of information, or maybe expanding the definition of what we think of as scholarly information. The traditional role of libraries, because there's a few of us in the room, is to select, collect, and preserve what we determine to be or think is scholarly information. What's your impression of what the role is of the libraries as...
So, for full disclosure, I'm actually my history is as an academic librarian. So I was at Columbia University for years. My area was exactly, and then they made me go to Microsoft. But I think to your point, my opinion, I think that the safe world of collecting books and collecting scholarly journals. It's been done. We figured it out. Yeah, we can kind of figure out, how do we get from 98% to 99 or 100%, but that's not the problem, and that's not where we're going to make the difference moving forward. It is data curation. It is provision of services. It is working directly with publishers or going around publishers and working directly with the scholars and saying, let's go.
Conceptually, it may have been done. It still takes an enormous amount of energy and money.
Absolutely. Exactly. No argument. But I would argue that that is taken as read. It still has to happen. It needs to happen behind the scenes. We are going to make the most incremental impact is all of the, what traditionally has been either, gray literature or the stuff that's been underneath the desk or on the shelves of the scientists. That's the stuff that's unique and that needs the brain power. What librarians and archivists have done for centuries, we've figured out we need to apply those skills to a new set of data, and that's my opinion.
And I'm a former librarian too, so I can be heretical, but you can divide it up into the curatorial and preservation aspects of the work, or you can look at the side of the actual scholarship and furthering scholarship, and those are two separate avenues and extremely difficult areas to tackle, but to Lee's upstream analogy here, I think that the big opportunity and the big place that the profession needs to go is to get into the laboratory, needs to be with the researcher, needs to be, when applications are being written to solve a problem, a lot of the times it's not being written with an eye to how the information comes out of the system.
Right.
So scientists create problems for themselves that then need to be solved.
Or they create a solution that makes sense for other scientists, but maybe won't cross a domain or won't make it easily available for other populations that might be interested in that data. And I think that's a value that librarians have been able to provide.
Thank you.
Yes.
Great talk. Thank you very much. I wanted to probe a little bit what you alluded to at the end, the sociological shift that might need to take place. And I've worked with scientists I'm a librarian too. I've worked with scientists for 10 years. My impression is it's not generally a sharing culture.
Right.
There was a piece in The Onion several months ago that says selfish scientists won't share data. It wasn't too far off the mark.
That's right, exactly. when reality and,
So I'm wondering if it's going to take, that may be true of we're older generation. The general generational thing is blurring with social networks like Facebook and Twitter. But
we can't wait.
I wonder if the shift it's going to take a generation for all this to sort itself out, because younger people coming in, they're used to blogs, they're used to communicating a lot, they're used to being not very private. But for example, two market researchers may not want to share things among themselves because they're competing for their products. I can see some cultures where it may make sense, but other cultures where there's going to be a ton of resistance.
Yeah. Again, I wish I had a canonical answer for you. The answer is there's a broad scale, and it's going to vary, from domain to domain. It's going to vary even within the domain. There's going to be innovators. There's going to be laggards. Are we going to have to wait a generation? In some cases, yes. In other cases, I don't think so. I think I've witnessed, you know, in the last 5 or 10 years, tremendous shifts external to Microsoft. Let's pick open source software. Let's say 5 years ago, there's no way the work that we're doing now would have been supported within Microsoft. And Microsoft has started to go, wait a minute, we need to think about markets in a different way. We need to engage with different communities in different ways. To a point now, we've created an open source foundation. There are parts of the company that are generating a lot of open source. And again, if you would have said to me 10 years ago, is Microsoft going to be thinking that way? I would have said never. And some of the most, proprietary thinking people in the company have now completely shifted. And so that kind of opportunity, that kind of potential reward is, I think, the incentive that we need to be able to demonstrate to scientists and to say, okay, you've been very proprietary about it, but if you can point to examples of where sharing actually helped a colleague or something else, some other type of situation, vastly improved a colleague's career.
Or helps you. I mean, the problem, yeah. The reason people don't share their data is because they run run an experiment, and they, in their mind, have 6 papers out of it. And as soon as you share your data, you're opening it up to the world, and you're hurting yourself. If the reward system was such that by sharing your data, that is also recognized as part of your contributions, then there's more incentive to do that.
And the other side of it, I think that you're talking about addressing, is if it's incredibly hard, no one wants to do it. If there's so many roadblocks and so many hurdles to sharing that data or making it talked with other data, then they're definitely not going to do it. But if you can create systems that facilitate that and make it ridiculously easy or even 5% easier than it is now, then that might be the incentive.
So.
And the one way to also give credit to the science that shares the data is by creating the data citations.
Yes.
We provided them
the
one way for all researchers to understand to get credit for what they do is have the number of citations, and sometimes they've been cited by the journal. So if the data can be cited too, that's an additional advantage.
Sounds like we should all be talking to her. Yes?
I will go back to the, I think it's related to your question and the upstream data services and the role of libraries. Let's imagine I gave you a beautiful young mind of a librarian and you can mold it into any way. What skills would you put in there? Because we all hear that that's necessary. But is this a computer scientist that we're talking about? Is it a hybrid between information expert of some sort, computer scientist, and a scientist in this subject? And you can describe
the word. Very interesting. I'm not going to be able to sit here and say, here are the 15 things you need to do, but I'll talk about. I mentioned the DataNet, solicitation that NSF put out. And so that's basically pulling together scientists, it's pulling together librarians and archivists, it's pulling together, in some cases, businesses. And it occurred to me that would be an amazing, if you could teach a class on what those guys are doing. And so I actually, Alex and I are both affiliated with the Information School at University of Washington, and I've explained to them about, I don't think you need to be training librarians the way we need to be training them. We need to start thinking about a service orientation and not reference interviews, but how do we start saying you need to build services, you need to build value-added services on top of the data? And it's literally, I think, to your point, I think it's getting them some classes over in the business school. It's getting some exposure to policy and legal in other areas. It's sitting down with the informatics groups, cheminformatics or bioinformatics, and getting these partnerships, multidisciplinary partnerships across departments. And I think that's the way that it has to go. I mean, everything is bleeding into kind of multidisciplinary work. But I get, as a librarian, I get a little frustrated when I go into a place and it's not a librarian doing the work, but it's a chemist doing the work. The chemist who got his PhD in chemistry is now doing work that I would traditionally think and suspect a librarian or an information professional should be doing, and I feel like that's a failing on our profession. Where the scientific domains have had to spill over into traditional things that librarians should be doing. And I think it's the onus is on the information schools to reclaim and in partnership, not in a competitive way, but to say, no, we're expert in doing that and all these other experiences, now we need to do it in your area as well. There's a lot that librarians have learned over, you know, a couple of centuries that we need to apply in those other areas.
We have time for one more question.
Yes.
I just want to follow up with the question Keith talked about. I noticed your Microsoft policy, internal policy, you put more and more information or your application code or your, you know, application design online and share with others, like, you know, before, you know, Microsoft sell everything for money. Have you, in your company, see the advantage or benefits yet after you put more and more information internal or your application code online or more and more put on web?
I wish I could say something like, "Yeah, we've seen, you know, Word usage spike or SharePoint license." The reason we're doing this in many ways, the reason that Microsoft specifically, Microsoft Research is doing this work, most academic institutions around the world have already licensed Microsoft software. You've already paid for it. The institution has already bought it. It may not be used. It may not be used by various departments or various people for various reasons. And what we're trying to say is, if you didn't know this functionality exists, it does. Or if it doesn't exist or it's not meeting your needs, let us help, you know, make sure that it does. And we can either build that or we can give your feedback to the product group and ensure that that is additional functionality. And so what we're fundamentally is we're not trying to say, hey, we've had a great benefit for Microsoft. They're trying to say, we want you to have the benefit because you've already, literally, your institutions have already purchased the software. We want to make sure that you deploy it and you have a positive experience doing that, and it helps you get your job done. And again, as a point that I made a little bit earlier, it's not that we want everyone to run, well, again, yes, that'd be ideal. We'd love to have everyone run, you know, Microsoft software all the time, but we know that that's probably not a reality, specifically when we get into, you know, specific domain applications. But we want to make sure that in that ecosystem that Microsoft's, you know, interoperable, that you can get data in and out, that we can, you know, play friendly and be part of that ecosystem in a positive. Thank you.